accession number 23370, reel 12.
How high were these profiles in relation to the ground that existed?
They varied. Our first sight of it was pretty forbidding in parts. The first bit of it was only a matter of a couple of feet high, but it was down into a valley. And of course, by the time we got to the bottom of the valley, you were looking at some that were about 3-4 metres high. That's quite a pile of dirt. We very quickly worked out that if we were going to shift that amount of dirt per man per day, first of all, just the digging out of the dirt was nothing. That was relatively easy, but to transport it, you had a bag that was laid flat and had wire connections from each corner of the bag up over the bamboo pole, which meant that you had two people required to transport the dirt. And if you worked in pairs, that meant that two of you dug the dirt out, put it onto a bag, then picked the bag up on the poles and walked up the bank with it and dumped it, then turned around and came back again. Not very efficient. So we worked out that if you worked in groups of six or eight, that you had a fairly continuous amount of work going on, but you changed all the time, that you would work for for an hour digging, then you would be on the cartage for another 2 hours, that sort of thing. And of course, instead of having an area of just 1 cubic metre, you had an area of 6 cubic metres with 6 people. And we very smartly worked out that, yes, that's very efficient. We can do it. We can do it quite easily. Do it standing on your head. Now, with the groups that we had, or with the party that we had, having Americans the Dutch, and the Dutch consisted mainly of native troops. They were Javanese. Now, most of the Australians had the advantage of being used to hard work, or relatively hard work, and we achieved our target quite easily. We watched a couple of the Yanks for a start, and they did this, two of them, running up and down the bank, and they very quickly ran out of steam. But they reckoned it was only a small amount of dirt, so they could stand it. But it didn't work out quite that easily. We were standing around by mid-afternoon, talking and not quite finishing your work, because we worked out that if we hopped into it in the morning while it was still fresh, you got most of your work done, so that when it came to the bad part of the day, such as from midday onwards, then you could cruise a little bit and still achieve your object, but not finish too early, because if you finish too early, you're obviously going to get more. Now the Yanks, they were finishing an hour and a half after us, and the poor Javanese blokes had never ever done any of this sort of thing in their life, or work of a different nature altogether. They weren't finishing it until dark. So the next thing that happened was that air load was increased. This took some time. It didn't occur straight away, but we finished up. We were doing a cubic metre and a half per man per day, and the Yanks had been bunged up to a metre and a half a day, but the Javanese were still only on a metre. Now at that time, we ran into one of the Japanese engineers. His name was Kakiuchi. He was a merchant seaman, and he'd been a mechanic or an engine room bike on this thing, and he personally took over all the Australian sailors. He thought Australian sailors were great. He could talk English, of course, quite fluently, and he would come and sit down with us and talk about all sorts of experiences, this bloke, and wanted to know how we'd been sunk and all the rest of it. And that's where this Johnny Ross that I spoke about previously came into his own, because he would sit down, and of course, being an old sea dog, he could talk about seagoing events and what have you for all his 40 odd years he'd been in the Navy. And he occupied this bloke very all the time that he was with us. And the whole time we were at the 18 kilo camp, which was some 2 months, I guess, he looked after us, made sure that we got the best bits of the work and all the rest of it. So we had a bit of a not a free ride, but we didn't have the hassles that the others got from the guards, because Kakiuchi would nick these blokes off as soon as they came near. A lot of the guards were Koreans, and there was this animosity between the Japanese and the Koreans, and Kakiuchi kept them off our backs. That was just an aside that that occurred, but it was quite interesting, because this bloke again came into our orbit later on, further down the line. But
I'm interested to hear that, because you hear a lot of the negative sides of the communication between the prisoners and the Japanese. I get the impression that it was possible to communicate fairly reasonably with some of them.
Oh yes, yeah. Well, some of them had a little bit of knowledge of English, etc. As a matter of fact, one of the administrators in the camp, a Korean, came forward with information, and this, mind you, would have been February, March 1943, and he came forward with the information then. This was just in a casual conversation that he'd been having with a group of blokes in the camp, and he came forward with information then that Japan wouldn't win the war. But within 100 years, Japan would own Australia. And that was, it was something that sort of struck you as being a little bit odd at the time, coming from the source that it did. But it was so prophetic, and so whether they will own Australia in that period, I don't know, but that's for somebody else to find out. But that's the sort of thing that came forward. Now and again, you picked up these bits as we went along. But yes, there was some some of them could communicate quite well and had very positive thoughts as far as the war and everything else was concerned.
In relation to your camp, what was its condition at the 18 kilometre?
It was our first camp under those conditions. It wasn't bad. It was a new camp had been set up, and it was still relatively clean. We had no problems with food other than the quantity of it and the variety of it, of course. But at that early time, we were also able to go across to, on finishing work, go to one of the elephant pools where the elephants used to wash and what have you, but it was a flowing stream, so it was quite good, and we could have a wash after work, which was very good, which meant that you could clean all the dust and muck off, etc., and go back to camp relatively clean and somewhat freshened, of course. That didn't occur at every camp, but it was really good there. Was quite good. So yes, 18 wasn't a bad camp. There again, early in the, because we were still early in the piece, we had a concert at that camp. We were allowed to put up a small stage area. When I say a stage, it was just merely a platform. The Japs were still pretty nervous about allowing anything to occur, we had we still had a couple of instruments in the camp, and there were a few people who could do their trick, like this bloke with his Carmen Miranda. He was still with us, and so they were quite good, but there was one occasion. Or at this concert that we had, we had a Dutchman who was sleight of hand artist, a magician in other words, and the Burmese who came out of the jungle and from the a couple of the kampongs, or whatever they call them, etc., up there, came in, and they sat up close to the stage. Behind them were the Japs, who were also watching, and then we were further back. But there was that line between us and the Burmese, you couldn't contact them. And this bloke got up with his sleight of hand business, and he made a little doll out of a handkerchief, put it down on the stage, then dangled his hands up and down, and the doll started to dance. That was caused a little bit of consternation, but you could see they very quickly recognised, oh, he's got some connections, some wires or something on there. So he did this business for a while, and the music that was being played by a bloke called Bandy. He was the one of the blokes off the Houston, and he played a flugelhorn, and he played this this thing, and I can remember the tune. He played Springtime in the Rockies, and sat back there and played this thing very quietly, and this blasted thing was dancing up and down. Anyway, however he did it, I don't know, but the next part of the act was that he dangled his hands up and down, the thing would dance. So that caused a bit of a laugh. So then he put his hands behind his back, walked away from this thing, the bloody thing got up and danced. every Burmese jumped up like that and was gone into the jungle, and half the Japs with them. They were seeing black magic. It was, because we roared with laughter. We thought it was a hell of a joke. But anyway, the Japs came back, and some of the Burmese came back, and the thing continued. But that was quite a highlight. It was quite a thing at the time. But I'm afraid those things were very few and far between, because it was starting to get a bit serious from there on.
Well, I was going to say, it doesn't sound too bad yet, but when was it that things started to deteriorate?
Within a matter of weeks from there, we shifted from 18 and we went up to 85. This was kilos from the from Tambazaya. And at the 85, again, we were in a camp. It had been used before, but it was all standard sort of camps. They were long bamboo huts, had up roof, half walls, and a passageway down the middle, and just a split bamboo decking inside on which you slept and that sort of thing. That was pretty standard right throughout. It was their normal way of making a hut. This was on there was a creek, a small river ran through the camp, which was very good as far as bathing was concerned, because that's was quite important. But the amount of work we had to do then, and we got into different territory. This is when we started to get into quite rocky territory, and we had to shift the same amount of stuff per man per day. It was just digging dirt. That was quite easy. But when it comes to rocks, and you suddenly find that you get bamboo, clumps of bamboo, and the bamboo I'm talking about were massive heaps of stuff, and to dig them out, of course, was just a terrific job. It's just so hard to get anywhere with it. And particularly the tools that you had were pretty primitive. You had a shovel, and there were some picks, but axes and that sort of thing, they were blunt and were broken easily and that sort of thing. So, yes, it was very difficult work. And at that time, in our party, we were... again, we were still doing a metre and a half of rock, bamboo, whatever it was, shifting that. And at this particular time, we were also into cuttings, which is quite difficult work when you've got only pretty primitive sort of tools to do it with.
Was it possible for you to explain to the Japanese the difficulties that you were having and see if you could improve the situation?
Oh yes, we used to explain to them constantly, but I've never got beyond just making a complaint. It was just a case of that was it. That's what you had to do, and that's what you got on with. If you if you hadn't completed your task by the time it got dark, well, you lit a fire and you worked by firelight until you'd finished. So there was no point in delaying the thing for any length of time at all.
What was the climate like at this point?
We hadn't got into the wet then, but it was... in that period, coming up to the wet, where it was starting to get quite humid, and the normally dry period of the before the monsoons and before the wet comes in, that had started to go, and of course we were starting to get quite humid weather, which didn't help matters at all. But we only started the 85 for quite a short period, and then we went to the went back towards Tambazite to the 80 kilo camp, and that was still extremely hard, and the same sort of country, the same problems, cuttings, rocks, and still the same amount of work, and these blasted heaps of bamboo, which were terribly hard to shift. And of course, once you pulled a clump of bamboo out, you had to get rid of the blasted stuff then. So if you were in a cutting, of course, it meant that moving this damn stuff was quite a job. So life didn't get any easier at all under those circumstances. And, of course, we were starting to get problems with health.
What were the first things that started to really bother you, health-wise?
Mainly malaria was my big problem, but I hadn't, even then I hadn't picked up the first dose up until that time when we were at the 80 kilo camp. That was, it was mainly just sheer physical exhaustion. That was the thing, because at that time we were working with this meter and a half of work per day, and as I say, you could stay. What they did make a concession that if you came back into camp after 1 o'clock in the morning, that you could have an extra hour in bed, which was quite facetious, because it didn't help one little bit, because if you the next day you still had the same task. So whether you started at 8 o'clock in the morning or started at 9 o'clock in the morning, you were still going to be in problems. So yes, exhaustion was the big thing, and we hadn't yet run into cholera. We'd only had severe problems with dysentery and diarrhea, etc. But it was at this camp that our friend Kakiuchi came back into the picture, and Johnny Ross, the our warrant officer, Blake, had succumbed. He was older than us, quite obviously, and he'd started to go downhill health-wise. The word got back to Kakiuchi somehow. He'd picked it up from somebody, and on one of his days off, this Kakiuchi had come up to our camp and had brought with him a packet of what was known as Gula Java, which is they're slabs of sugar in an unrefined form. And it's just wrapped in banana leaf, that sort of thing, and also a dozen eggs. Now, that was absolutely out of this world, he came all the way down the line to the camp, and of course had to make his way into the camp via the guardhouse, and they didn't like him very much, but he came in, and he gave his stuff to Johnny Ross, and that literally saved his life at that point. So that was another strange little episode that that occurred, but it showed that there was some humanity or something that was still abounding somewhere, but in him it was quite good.
Well, you're beginning to sort of question the sort of point of it all. What sort of philosophy were you beginning to adopt, do you think, as young blokes in a jungle building a railway?
Not too much philosophy. You were too tired to worry too much about this sort of thing, because you were working constantly. Initially, they said a day off in every 10, but those days sort of seemed to get skipped most of the time, and the big push was on. The railway, of course, was to connect with the line that went up to Rangoon and through further towards the Indian border, and was to transport troops. So obviously they were going to attack India through that that way. We weren't very impressed, but there was nothing much that we could do about it. You could perform little acts of sabotage, but they were pretty meaningless, really. We had engineers with us the whole time, this engineering group. They were with us all the time, and of course we're watching for not for sabotage specifically, but they were watching to see the job was done properly in things like building bridges and that sort of thing that you became involved in.
The feat of the work that was in the endeavour of it, to build this railway through such impenetrable jungle and terrain, says something for the engineers in a way.
Yes, it was sheer brute force that did the thing. That's as I understand it, the planning of the thing in its entirety had been done by an English group some yonks beforehand.
Had the engineers that you were dealing with now, had they told you how long you had to get it done?
Oh yes, sir. There was the lines had to be connected. We had to be through to the border, which was at 135 kilo line. That had to be done within 12 months, and that was the program.
How did that sort of keep you going?
Didn't keep us going. You were just concerned with getting your amount of work done so that you get back to the camp and be able to rest. That was...
Presumably there would have been serious consequences had you not finished in that time. Was that an incentive to work even harder, do you think?
No, you tried to balance it, that you didn't kill yourself working, but you still had to have rest and you still had to have food and that sort of thing. So you balance it out. But there were days when you thought you were never going to finish that task, and particularly as you got on into the night, of course you get very tired, and rolling bloody great lumps of rock around in the middle of the night in jungle territory was not the not the greatest incentive to work, to keep going. But the attitude of most of the people in the camp as well. It's got to be done. We've got to do it because if you don't, you're not going to get out of here. It's the only way to get out.